Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Quick, name the fastest growing minority group in the United States. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, that distinction goes to Asian Americans, who make up a little under 6% of the total population today. Many have arrived since the passage of the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, abolished old quotas designed to limit their numbers by country, and instead select immigrant candidates based on job skills. Of course, millions of people of Asian descent have been born on U.S. soil since the first Asians ever arrived in the mainland U.S. in the 16th century. Today, Asians are sometimes seen as the model minority, a term that sounds like a compliment but obscures the fact that Asian Americans have faced centuries of discrimination, and some immigrant Asian communities remain challenged by hardship and poverty in 2015. Erica Lee is director of the Immigration History Research Center at the University of Minnesota. Her new book is The Making of Asian America, A History. Erica, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
You note that the history of Asian Americans is also a history of immigration. And immigration from Asia is tied to the history of American colonial and military presence in Asia.
Absolutely. So if we think about the most recent migrations before 1965 and then soon thereafter, we know that a large number of folks started coming directly involved with U.S. military occupation. So war brides coming in who were married to U.S. servicemen or Korean or other Asian adoptees who were adopted by U.S. military or fathered by U.S. military servicemen and then brought to the United States. And then more recently and more dramatically, after 1975 and the fall of Saigon, the arrival of 1.2 million refugees from Southeast Asia following the fall of Saigon.
It's worth noting here, as you do throughout the book, that Asian immigrants represent well over 20 distinct ethnic identities. Can you talk about the pros and cons of sort of lumping them under a single umbrella term in order to consider the history of Asians' arrival and assimilation?
Absolutely. And I think that's the challenge and also an opportunity for any of us who study immigration. We know that Latinos also make up a vast array of diverse ethnic groups as well. And so what are some of the benefits of bringing all of those groups together when the diversity is so great? So Asian Americans make up folks like my family that has been in this country for six generations, but also the international students who arrived on campus yesterday. What are our similarities? What are the differences? So at first glance, it may seem that there's more differences according to class and generation, immigration status, assimilation into the United States. But then when we think about the commonalities, the ways in which America, American society and politicians and laws have for centuries lumped Asian peoples together, often to discriminate against them, and then also have how Asian Americans have joined together, often to combat that discrimination, you can see both the complicated ways in which this works.
Is the process by which Asian immigrants and their descendants become American different in a significant way from that of any other immigrants?
It is. I think because of this long history that America has had of treating Asian immigrants as different from other immigrants. So the first Asians to arrive in great numbers really coincides with the great arrivals of migrations from Europe beginning in the mid-19th century. But we know that from the very beginning, from the moment that these different immigrants set foot on U.S. soil, there were different opportunities available to them. So let's just take the example of the ability to become a naturalized citizen. Our laws, dating back to 1790, stated that naturalized citizenship was only available to free white persons. So when that came to immigrants, folks like Italians were quote-unquote white on arrival, but Asians were barred from becoming naturalized citizens. And that really had some some great consequences, not only for that immigrant generation not being able to feel fully American, not being able to vote, not being able to not being counted as American, but also for the second generation who, even though they were born in the United States and were birthright citizens, still never fully felt fully American and still faced discrimination in their everyday lives.
I was absolutely astonished to read about something that the United States did to U.S.-born women, U.S. citizens of Asian descent in the 19th century. If they happened to marry an Asian immigrant, they lost their U.S. citizenship.
That's right. So for a long time, this these bars, these prohibitions on Asians becoming naturalized citizens had longstanding repercussions as well to the U.S.-born women, Asian American women born in the United States who married Asian immigrant men. So there was a code word that the U.S. government used to apply to Asian immigrants, and that was, quote, aliens ineligible to citizenship. And for a period of time, if you were a woman, a U.S. citizen woman who married a quote-unquote alien ineligible to citizenship, you also lost your U.S. citizenship as well. It was, you know, really dated back to this idea that a woman's citizenship followed her husband's. And so those laws were eventually changed. But for a generation of women, there was a period of time when they were essentially stateless.
The first Asians began to arrive in the Americas in the 16th century. I have to tell you, Erica, this is something that was left out of the history that I learned in school.
Mine too. I mean, this was the challenge for me in writing this book is, how far back do I go? The initial starting points in any standard book about Asian Americans really begins with the California Gold Rush when the mass migrations begin. Tens of thousands come in the 1850s. But the more that I researched, I realized that that migration to California was only made possible by an earlier migration that went to Latin America that brought South Asian and Chinese coolies, indentured laborers or indentured servants, to work on the sugar plantations in Latin America. And then that migration was only made possible because there had been a longstanding, centuries-old trans-Pacific trade of Spanish ships going across the Pacific from the Spanish Philippines to Spanish America. And on those ships came an estimated 40 to 100,000 Asians as sailors, as servants, and as slaves. And they really integrated themselves into New Spain, which is now Mexico.
Hmm. From the earliest days of Asian immigration, Americans of European descent used race as a justification for treating Asians as less than equal. What did white Americans see as the problem with extending citizenship rights to Asians?
This is one of those fascinating ways in which the story of Asian Americans really intersects with the story of race in the United States and the ways in which we treated African Americans, we saw American Indians, and also Hispanics. So Asian immigrants, and we really are talking about Chinese as the first who are coming in large numbers in the 19th century, they're arriving at a critical time in U.S. history. It's the 1850s. California had just been admitted into the Union as a free state, as opposed to Missouri, a slave state. We're going to be engaged in a bloody, divisive civil war around the meaning of freedom and slavery and race and citizenship. And the fact that Chinese immigrants, the first group of immigrants who are not of European descent, are coming in at this time is really raising questions about, well, what do we do with them? They're neither white nor black. We have a huge race problem, even after the Civil War, that we're trying to solve through Jim Crow laws, segregation. You know, where does a group like Chinese immigrants fit in? And for most of the 19th and into the early 20th century, really up through World War II, Chinese and other Asian immigrants are more treated similarly to African Americans and other minorities than they are to European immigrants. It's really not until World War II and later that some of those discriminatory laws change. The gates open up a little bit, and now we're faced with a new kind of stereotype, Asian Americans as the model minority.
And that's something that you find really troubling, in part because it leaves out the fact that many Asians have had to overcome extraordinary hardships, and many groups of Asian Americans in this country today are having a harder time than the general population just achieving a middle-class lifestyle.
Right. So this idea that the Asian Americans are the model minority, meaning essentially that they're the model for other minorities, and they're the model because they're doing things right. They're working hard. They've got strong family values. They're acing their SATs. They're achieving high educational rates and economic success, all without complaining, with no protesting in the streets, no loud organizing, that this is supposedly the right way to make it in America. And there's a couple of problems with this stereotype. One is it's extremely inaccurate. On the one hand, there are groups of Asian Americans, especially those who arrive with advanced degrees already, who are on one side of the economic spectrum. But then there are others, including those who arrive with minimal skills or who are fleeing war and persecution, who still struggle in generational poverty. So that the rate of Asian Americans who are living in poverty for some groups is much, much higher than the U.S. average.
So in the mid-1800s, when immigration from Asia, and particularly China, gained so much momentum in the United States, was the draw jobs in the railroad industry? Was the draw jobs in gold mining? For what reason did people come?
People came because the U.S. And U.S. companies recruited them. So we can go through every single group. And there's one sort of saying that migration scholars often use to describe migration, and that is, we are here because you were there. So Americans first went to China looking for trade. They looked to import luxury goods. They started to establish these well-tuned transportation systems, steamships that were bringing goods, and then eventually people to the Americas and to the United States. And as the U.S. West was industrializing, exploiting the natural resources through lumber and mines and building the railroads, they're looking to Asia for labor. This is, of course, after slavery. So Chinese are recruited to build the railroads. Japanese are recruited to labor in the Hawaiian sugar plantations, then Koreans, then South Asians, and then Filipinos. So it's really a business transaction that brings Asian immigrants to the United States.
Was the 19th century assumption that those individuals would go home after they had made their money?
You know, I don't think that American businesses were thinking that far ahead. They were certainly thinking that about Mexican migrants, that they were essentially the ideal migrants because they could essentially go home. But the idea was, let's just get the labor here first, and perhaps we'll worry about whether they stay or not later. Of course, when Asian immigrants did stay and when they started to call for their families, we do see an increase in anti-Asian sentiment and laws that eventually would exclude Asians.
We'll talk about those in just a minute with my guest, Erica Lee. She is director of the Immigration History Research Center at the University of Minnesota and author of the new book, The Making of Asian America, A History. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is director of the Immigration History Research Center at the University of Minnesota, Erica Lee. Her new book is called The Making of Asian America, A History. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Erica, as we've said, that first really big wave of Asian immigrants came from China. What specific proscriptions on Chinese citizenship were enacted in 1882?
1882 is the date that the U.S. Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, and this is the first time in our history that we barred and singled out an immigrant group for exclusion. So we didn't bar all Chinese immigrants. We barred the largest group that were coming over, and that is laborers. So it really excluded the vast majority of Chinese who would have wanted to come to the United States. But we did leave the door open slightly to people who we did want to come, so merchants, because we wanted to engage in business with China. Diplomats, of course, we need to let them in. Travelers, teachers, and students. We eventually, only after Chinese in America lobbied for through the federal court system, we eventually allowed in the wives and children of merchants and U.S. citizens, so birthright citizens of Chinese descent who are born in the United States.
What were Americans so afraid of from Chinese immigrants?
You know, the congressional testimony of this time is really fascinating, and I have to say that if one were to read that now and not know what date it was, we might think that they're talking almost today, where, you know, mm-hmm. when there's a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment being expressed today. But the testimony was, we need to close the gates. It's an inferior civilization. They're going to overrun our country. This is a question of life or death. The future of America relies on barring the gates to Chinese immigrants. And the arguments were really across the spectrum. They're taking away jobs from white working men. They're racially inassimilable. We already have a race problem with our own African Americans. We don't need another one. And you know, thinking about China's teeming millions, if we let some in, we're going to encourage mass migration of all of Asia. So some of these arguments eerily sound very familiar to some of the things we're hearing today.
And in time, immigrants from other Asian countries were essentially lumped in with those from China in being excluded from immigrating to the U.S.
Right. And so this goes back to your earlier question about of lumping all of the Asian groups together. But we know that we exclude the Chinese. And the irony is that they're the only group that's being excluded. We're a country that is in desperate need of labor. So we're still admitting millions of immigrants from Europe who are working in the factories. And the industrialists, the businesses along the West Coast realize we still need labor too. So they start recruiting laborers from Japan and Korea and South Asia and the Philippines. But as soon as those groups come in sizable numbers, then the anti-immigrant activists react as well. And you see arguments in the newspapers saying things like, this is just another Chinese immigration problem, but even worse. And then, or this is the third Asiatic invasion or another immigrant menace. So they really use the so-called Chinese immigrant problem as a template for how the other immigrant groups are seen in a negative light as well.
Had Chinese immigrants caused a problem? I mean, ostensibly some of them came over and didn't make a lot of money, but were there specific complaints that people had against these immigrants?
Well, the typical complaints about taking jobs, the reality is that business owners, the railroad barons, the big four, the industrialists that included Leland Stanford, who would, of course, go on to build a great university in Palo Alto, they were doing a cost-benefit analysis. They had Irish workers as well, but they felt that they could get away with paying Chinese laborers even less and work them harder. This was an economic calculation on the part of business owners. And Chinese immigrants in particular, they were shunned out of most other professions. So the reality is they weren't taking away white working men's jobs. They were shunted into specific areas by businesses, and then they found their own niches by running restaurants and laundries, jobs that no one else wanted to do.
And some semblance of the Chinese Exclusion Act remained in place until the 40s.
Until 1943, when the U.S. and China became allies during World War II, and it really became a highly awkward situation for the U.S. government to be promoting its new friendship with China, but then realizing that it was really not letting any of its new allied subjects into the country. And so it was more of a public relations campaign because the quotas that China was given at that time was just over 100 people per year.
Ironically, in 1943, of course, we had ramped up our shameful treatment of Japanese Americans after the bombing at Pearl Harbor.
Right. So World War II is a fascinating era of American history for so many reasons. But one of the areas that I think that often gets forgotten is this really complicated relationship to Asian Americans. So most students have learned about the incarceration of Japanese Americans. This was 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry. Two-thirds of them are U.S. citizen-born children who are forcibly removed from the West Coast, put into assembly centers, and then incarcerated in camps in the interior U.S. This is really the high point of anti-Asian racism that had been brewing and been in practice for decades. But at the same time, we're opening doors a little bit to other Asian immigrant groups like the Chinese and the repeal of the Chinese exclusion law. So it's this fascinating kind of twists and turns at this time period that would lay the foundation for some of the later developments in recent decades.
How has American treatment of Asian immigrants influenced immigration policy elsewhere in the world?
So that's another fascinating part of this history that really was one of the first starting points for me, because I have long been interested in the ways in which the U.S. makes decisions about who do we let in and who do we keep out and how does that change over time. But it wasn't until recently that I started thinking about the ways in which U.S. policy has repercussions in other countries. And I started looking back through the history of Asian exclusion and realized that almost simultaneously, as the U.S. was passing its own exclusion laws, our neighboring countries were also passing restrictive immigration laws. And one of the reasons why is because when we barred Chinese immigrants to the United States, there was still a need for Chinese immigrant labor and there was still a demand to come to the United States. So Chinese did what many other immigrant groups have done since then. They simply found another way to come. And one of the ways they did this was by crossing the U.S. Canadian border and by crossing the U.S. Mexican border without documentation. So they essentially became America's first undocumented immigrants. And in light of this, Canada and Mexico started to pass its own laws to restrict Chinese immigration because of because they were being used as backdoors into the United States.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Chris. I worked for a number of years in New York City as a national park interpreter at Ellis Island, where we talked about Chinese Exclusion Act and all of this. But the context generally had to do with Europe. We did answer a lot of questions about the West Coast and Angel Island. And I'm wondering, it has never had the attention in a national conversation that Ellis Island has had. Ellis is a national park. I think Angel Island is part of a state park. I think it's lumped with Alcatraz. I'm not sure. But it It has been open somewhat, but it hasn't had nearly the funding or attention. Have you visited there, and what are your observations about that?
Thanks, Maggie. Thanks for bringing up Angel Island. It's one of my favorite topics to talk about. And I do this all the time. I asked my students yesterday, how many of you have ever heard of Angel Island? And there were just a few hands. And then I say, how many of you have heard of Ellis Island? And of course, almost the whole room raised their hands. And you're right. So Ellis Island is the gateway to America. 52 million immigrants, mostly from Europe, are coming through. We have these really, we have a warm spot in our heart for Ellis Island. It really represents the best of America, the huddled masses yearning to breathe free. But we know very little about its sister, Angel Island, which is in San Francisco Bay. And when it opened in 1910, it was called the Ellis Island of the West. And there's much fewer immigrants, 500,000, who are coming through Angel Island, mostly from Asia. And it served quite a different purpose because our immigration laws for so long really welcomed, for the most part, immigrants from Europe. But because our immigration laws for so long, for the most part, excluded Asian immigrants, Angel Island is more of a detention center, a prison, a barracks, rather than a welcoming or processing center that Ellis Island served. And so, yes, I have visited Angel Island many times. My own grandparents came through both Ellis Island and Angel Island, and I write a lot about my own family's experience through Angel Island in this book and in previous books. And I'm very involved in the ongoing campaign to preserve and share the histories of immigrants of across the board, including Europe and Latin America, who came through Angel Island. And I'm happy to say that Angel Island is now a National Historic Landmark. Its ongoing efforts to preserve its buildings are really ramping up, and more and more people are learning about that history and how it represents a more complicated but perhaps more realistic portrayal of America's relationship to immigration.
What drew your grandparents here, if you don't mind taking a little tangent, and what did they have to go through in order to feel fully accepted into the United States?
Yeah, so this was another fun aspect of researching the book, because I don't think you fully get to know all of the skeletons in your own family history until you start asking questions. But both sets of grandparents on my maternal and paternal sides are immigrants, and so for most of my life, my sisters and I believed we were third generation American. But it wasn't until digging a little deeper, then I came to realize that on my grandmother's side, the roots go way back, that our first ancestor came for the California Gold Rush in 1854. And I assume that he came just like so many others who were driven by those dreams of gold. We don't know if he struck it rich, but he must have done pretty well, because the first time that we have records of him through the U.S. government is that he is in New York City already by the 1870s, 1880s. He probably founded one of the first businesses in New York City, Chinatown. By the 1890s, he has a couple of different businesses in New York and Philadelphia. But the tragedy of this is that he essentially remains alone in the United States because it was so difficult to bring wives and children over. And so the family for three generations remained separated by the Pacific Ocean. And it really wasn't until my grandmother came over that the family settled down and placed roots in the United States and finally became Chinese American.
How have those stories of your family's arrival in the U.S. shaped your perception of your own identity? On the one hand, it was a long time ago. On the other hand, it continues to inform who you are.
Absolutely. And I think the answer is a little bit broader for all of us who are interested in immigration or family history. I think of American history as broadly a history of many family histories, of many family journeys, whether they've been internal within the United States or from somewhere else to the United States. And I think that for me, especially, the absences, you know, the holes in that family history, as well as what was continually emphasized, you know, this idea that we came here for a better life, we have to work hard, et cetera, combined, both the absences and the often repeated stories made me wonder, what else is there that may be missing in the American history story? What other gaps might there be? If my grandparents didn't even pass on their stories to their own grandchildren, where are they in American history? Whose other grandparents' stories are not in American history? And how can we search for them and make them part of this larger tapestry of who we are and where we've been?
As a historian, there must be challenges to telling those grassroots stories that don't exist when you're just trying to get the numbers of, say, you know, Koreans who entered the United States in 1958, you know?
Right. You know, the wonderful thing about being a historian is that it's like being a detective or an archaeologist. It's like digging through things and finding sources in places that you never knew existed. So in this book, because it does go so far back, I was researching in archives that deal with European colonization and exploration, and I analyze in great detail the very first printed map of the world. But then because it comes all the way up to the present, I was also listening to hip-hop lyrics and going on to Twitter and trying to figure out, you know, what Asian Americans are saying through social media. But the other thing is that so many of us, everyday Americans, are through our community organizations, through historical societies, through churches, we've also become so good at recording the experiences of everyday Americans. So I really relied a lot on oral history projects that communities did to preserve their own histories.
Erica Lee is my guest. She's director of the Immigration History Research Center at the University of Minnesota and author of the new book, The Making of Asian America, A History. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. And if you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Erica Lee, who directs the Immigration History Research Center at the University of Minnesota. Her new book is The Making of Asian America, A History. Erica, talk about the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965 and how Congress was convinced that the time had come to make this change.
Yes, so next month it'll be the 50th anniversary, and it's such an important time to be thinking about how this law really reshaped our nation of immigrants, but also why it's so tough to talk about immigration today and why it's been so difficult to pass comprehensive immigration reform again. So the laws in place in 1965 were just an extension of those harsh Asian exclusion laws, but they were extended to almost every other immigrant group. It was explicitly discriminatory. In 1924, we passed laws that essentially granted every country a quota, but those quotas were stacked. They really privileged immigration from Northern and Western Europe because scientists and politicians and the American public, in essence, believed that peoples from Northern and Western Europe, the so-called Nordic and Anglo-Saxon races, were purer, they were superior, and those were the type of immigrants we wanted to come. In contrast, we were very concerned about the growing numbers from Southern and Eastern Europe and also wanted to continue to bar Asians. So from 1924 to 1965, the immigration really plummeted. Countries like Italy and Poland had their quotas. A number of people who were allowed to come in, they were dropped by 90%. And by 1965, finally, the American public was in a mood for change, but more importantly, U.S. international relations and the civil rights movement really demanded that we take a better look at immigration policy. Blatant discrimination was just not going to fly in the wake of the civil rights movement and the passage of the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act, and it absolutely wasn't going to work during the Cold War when we're trying to convince allies to join us rather than the Soviet Union and the communist system of government.
And yet, here is President Johnson parsing the terms of the Immigration Act for a broader U.S. audience in 1965.
This bill that we will sign today is not a revolutionary bill. It does not affect the lives of millions. It will not reshape the structure of our daily lives or really add importantly to either our wealth or our power. Yet it is still one of the most important acts of this Congress and of this administration, for it does repair a very deep and painful flaw in the fabric of American justice. It corrects a cruel and enduring wrong in the conduct of the American nation.
It sounds a little bit, Erica, like he's acknowledging white American fears that somehow relaxing restrictions on immigration that have existed from these places that people consider to be inferior sources of immigrants might somehow be detrimental to the interests of native-born Americans.
Right. So he's really trying to play both sides,
right?
That it's a historic law. It's one of the most important of his administration. But don't worry.
But nothing will change.
It's not a revolutionary bill, and it won't affect the lives of millions. And this is a reflection of the debates in Congress. So the 1965 Immigration Act, the idea for reform was really rooted in President John F. Kennedy's plan. And he submitted a plan for immigration reform just 4 months before he was assassinated. So there was a lot of political will to continue that legacy and to pass immigration reform. But there were many in Congress who really needed assurances that the U.S. was not going to become, quote, a dumping ground for the peoples of Latin America, Africa, and Asia. And again, those same anxieties. One congressman actually said, don't you think we already have enough problems with our own Negroes? Do we really want to admit more, you know, say from the Caribbean? So the Johnson administration really is spending a lot of time convincing congressmen that there's not going to be much change, that there will be only a few thousand Indians, for example, that would come in the next 5 years, and not to worry, that this is really more about the principle of a open and fair immigration policy for U.S. foreign policy goals rather than a radical restructuring of American society.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Mike on the line in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I go by Mike, American name, but my real name is Murali. I'm Indian. I was wondering, there are two parts to my question. One is, how were Chinese able to integrate themselves so successfully when Mexicans are having so much of trouble here now? And second question is, would you be able to comment about Indian immigration from India? Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for your call.
Sure. So on the first question, how have Chinese been able to integrate so successfully? Chinese have been here for a long time. So it's a question about length of residence. It's a question of how long it takes for an immigrant group of any background to you know, feel at home and to integrate. So, for example, again, my family's been here for six generations. But at the same time, there are more recent immigrants who are coming from China who already know English, who are already learning English, and can speak very well when they come to the United States. We know that across the board, whatever immigrant group, that there are struggles with that first generation. But we also know that by the second generation, because of programs in the schools and because of the, you know, the huge, giant efforts of immigrants themselves, that by the second generation, that integration is almost complete, almost to a detriment, where there's many second-generation Americans who can no longer speak the language of their parents. So even amongst Mexicans, the integration rate is really quite good. And then in terms of migration from India, has been one of the fastest growing trends in recent years. They're the second largest group that is coming in today. The increase since 1965 has really been astronomical. There's 3.5 million in the United States. Compare that to pre-World War II levels when just around 8,000 were able to come. They come with largely high professional skills, educational status. They're highly recruited. At the same time, there are many who are coming through family reunification categories who may not have as much education or skill. So Indian immigrants are a great microcosm of the trends of Asian immigrants more broadly, represented at both ends of the economic spectrum, but definitely growing in number and growing in political power. Two governors in the South, Nikki Haley of South Carolina and Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, are of Indian descent. And of course, Jindal is a presidential candidate. So definitely a group that has made huge strides in the past 50 years.
As Europe grapples with these questions of a very large influx of refugees from Syria and some other places, it causes me to think back on the history of U.S. now citizens who have come as refugees from Asian countries. They've had a harder time over the years. The Hmong are still, in many cases, living at a greater rate of poverty than their neighbors. Can you talk a little bit about the specific situation of Asian immigrant refugee populations?
Right. So if 2015 is the year that we're honoring or recognizing the 50th anniversary of the Immigration Act, 2015 is also the year that we're recognizing 40 years since the fall of Saigon, so the end of the wars in Southeast Asia and the beginnings of refugee resettlement of 1.2 million from Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. And the story of resettlement is one that really does give us quite a few lessons for what we may be thinking about in terms of the refugee crisis that's happening in Europe and elsewhere today. The first refugees really voted with their feet. The U.S. government, much like the EU, had no plan, had no real plan to resettle and or evacuate large numbers of refugees from all of these different countries. We did airlift a couple hundred thousand Vietnamese at first, but then we paid very little attention to those who were also victims of war in Cambodia and Laos. And they voted with their feet. They started going to refugee camps in Thailand, where eventually we did change our laws to resettle them and bring them to the United States. It's something that U.S. nonprofits, churches, community organizations really banded together to do, to show our humanitarian effort. The social services, the schools have become very adept at assisting refugees, but it hasn't come without bumps. And so you're right, there are large numbers of Hmong, Cambodian especially, and Lao refugees and Americans who still suffer from that those educational gaps, struggle in poverty, and still need assistance.
as Asian immigration to the U.S. continues to expand, what can we learn from looking at states like California, which has the largest Asian population, Asian American population of any U.S. state?
California is really an interesting state because it has both a history of anti-immigrant sentiment, even dating more recently to Proposition 187 in 1994 that proposed to bar undocumented immigrants from receiving public services, including education, but then more recently, under the current administration and more recently, has really turned around and has become more welcoming to immigrants and less punitive. So there's lots of lessons. California recently has become, it's clear that it's the Latino population is growing, outnumbering whites in the Bay Area. 1 in 4 people are Asian American. And we can look to California and also places like Texas, where some of these, both the battles, but also some innovative solutions about immigrant integration, balancing economic needs with humanitarian needs, fairness, are really being played out, and that the federal government can take some lessons from.
Is there a dilution of the effect of the culture of whatever country your family originates in as the generations go by? And is this something to be regretted? Is it something to be celebrated? I wonder if you've seen this within your own family.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I could be called a bad Chinese American because, you know, do I really cook well, you know, Chinese food? The language for me is very difficult. It's something that I had to learn in college rather than within my own household. But it's also a very American story, and it's really happening every day, including with second generation and even amongst the immigrant generation, just like our earlier caller. When we adopt English or Americanized names, those are choices that we make. America has always been, for immigrants, a conundrum. How much do we hold on to the ancestral land? And when we're holding on to that ancestral land and those customs, you know, we forget that the ancestral land has already changed. And so, in fact, some of the things that are quote unquote Chinese American really aren't Chinese at all, because China itself has grown by leaps and bounds and has changed. And it wouldn't be a place that even my grandparents would recognize. And so America is a place where we reinvent our identity. You know, for us to be German American is something very different than what it means to be really German today. And that's okay. It really makes, our society and what it means to be an American rich, diverse, interesting, always dynamic, always changing, and fluid. And I'm hopeful that as we continue to have these debates over immigration, that we continue to remember that, you know, we are a nation of immigrants. We've survived. We've thrived through immigration. And the next generation is the better for it.
Erica Lee is director of the Immigration History Research Center at the University of Minnesota and author of the new book, The Making of Asian America, A History. Erica, it's been such an interesting conversation. Thank you for making time for us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Lauren Aguirre. Jeff Whittington is executive producer of the show. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email is think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.